Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The Wake Up Call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
And welcome, welcome, welcome everybody on a beautiful Sunday morning. I don't know. I think it's tomorrow. First day of spring is tomorrow. But we will do our thing and make it all happen. It is the 20th of March, however it works. And we will make it all good here for you because we're going to have a show on a murder mystery. A mystery of some sort. And that will do your thing for the morning. Let me thank the folks at Crozet and the Valley's 101.1. And I see the phone is ringing already. People just can't stand when it's either their love of me or their love of Rusty Sempre and can't believe that he's gone or why I only get an hour. Hang on just a second. 979-0919 is the phone call. You'll be wanting that later in the hour as we try and tell the mystery of Pat Collins with Barbara Norton. Barbara, how are you?
I'm good, and the reason I was wildly gesticulating is that today is the spring equinox at 7-Eleven this evening.
See, we should have you on all the time. Are you a weather person?
I am I watch the phases of the moon, and I'm very attuned to the equinox and the solstice.
A meteorologist, the solstice queen, but we're not going to talk about that for the hour.
No, we're not.
No, we're not. Although, does that play any role in the mystery of Pat Collins?
It doesn't. I just feel that last night was the supermoon, so-called, and today's the spring equinox, and then Tuesday will be the 25th anniversary of the day Pat disappeared. So I feel like the planets are kind of aligning, maybe.
Could be. Could be. All right. We do have Barbara Norton on today, an author, a columnist. Next week, you'll see the article. You can find these things already on the sort of WikiLeaks website, PatCollinsCase.com, www, for those of you who don't know, PatCollinsCase.com, because next week, this will be the cover story, the headline article in next week's Hook. And you can see it all there. You can see tons of pictures, but we're going to surprise many of you with a little previous set. And, you know, Barbara, before we get too deep into this, because I don't assume there's so many new people. This is a 25-year-old story now.
Yes.
And you have done articles on this. How many times? You've been on this program years ago. I don't think you've been on, maybe you did the 20th anniversary conversation. But you've had a handful of stories about this. Why are you doing this again? I don't assume that many people in Charlottesville are familiar with the story. Many are, many are not. So we'll get in and we'll tell a little background about this. But why are you still interested?
I describe Pat's story as the consuming passion of my life. I don't know why it seems so riveting to me and so imperative that I do everything I can to keep the story alive. I never give up hope, and I feel more hopeful with this last article that someone somewhere will come forward and finally say what happens, or that they knew something, and that someone might eventually be able to find where Pat was buried, because I do believe he was murdered, and that maybe someday we'll even know who did it.
We did get a call confirming what you said, that call that was ringing 979-0919. Michelle from Richmond Spring comes in this evening, and she's calling for the love of Rick. Sorry, Rusty.
Let me take
a moment and thank Dixon Disposal for allowing us to be on the air for the hour with Barbara. Dixon reminds you that you can reduce household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can keep our planet green for years to come. But when Dixons picks up your trash, they sort and separate it for recycling. You can help the planet stay green with curbside service from Dixon Disposal at your home or business. More, 978-2111. Online, it's DixonDisposal.com. All right, so Barbara Norden here to talk about the Pat Collins mystery. And we'll get into the background on that and tell the story a little bit. Barbara, this the 25 years old when Pat Collins first disappeared. You've been doing this for quite some time now, and you said because you want to find, I guess, the person who did this, the responsible person, the criminal. But what I found in doing my homework for this is it also seems like not just finding the murderer, but blaming the university.
Yes, and I have to say I wish I'd been 25. I was actually 34. I'm an elderly person these days. Yes, the University of Virginia, as far as I'm concerned, acted in an egregious way toward the grieving family. First off, and just for people who are coming in new to this, Pat was a graduate student in physiology, which is in Jordan Hall at the Medical Center. On April 4th, 1986, a fellow graduate student realized that no one had seen Pat for a while, and they worked back 2 weeks. March 22nd was the last time anyone had seen him. Later, an ATM receipt for the 23rd was found. As of 2:27 p.m. March 23rd at Commonwealth Center, he disappeared into thin air and has never been seen or heard from again. Once the university was called, they dispatched a University of Virginia Police Department, UVAPD officer, who was very dismissive. Now, you have to understand, universities get tons of missing student calls, and yes, indeed, most of them have gone off under stress, and they do come back. But the people in the room with the officer were saying, no, this is not Pat, and pointing out that all the stuff they found left on his desk in a room in Jordan Hall, they found his backpack, glasses, wallet, driver's license, student ID, and his keys. And that was very weird because Pat had even put a sign on the door. He was so worried about people leaving that room unlocked. And another graduate student said, that just doesn't seem right. From that point on, the UVAPD seemed determined to convince anyone involved that Pat had walked away, that he had planned to leave his life. Even though so much of his stuff was at Jordan Hall and the rest of his stuff was at his home in Belmont, his car, his two bikes, another wallet he used for cash, his credit card, his checkbook, the only things missing were the clothes he was wearing, his diver's watch, and the $40 he'd taken out of the ATM. But the university, for some reason, just seemed bent on trying to prove that he had voluntarily left. And what I've heard is that the word on the police grapevine is that he was gay and he didn't want to come out to his quote-unquote militaristic stepfather. Now, his stepfather, Clarence Shannon, is far from militaristic. He was a military hero, but he had three Purple Hearts. That does not make a person quote-unquote militaristic, and he's not at all. Pat was very close to Shannon, to his stepfather, Clarence. So I suspect, frankly, this is totally speculation, that early on the UVA police, whether this is correct or not, suspected that Pat might have been gay, and I believe that they were homophobic enough to just say, well, there you have it. You know, he was gay, couldn't handle it, he just disappeared. However, he was excited to be here. He was doing well enough in his studies. He was glad to be on the East Coast and starting this new part of his life. I have the notes he was studying. He was studying his cell physiology notes before he left. He just spent $200 on a bunch of physiology books, and he hadn't cleared out his checking account. As the UVAPD was quick to say, they said that he had withdrawn $200 from his account and zeroed it out. No, he hadn't. And they admitted the next day that was not true. So it got to the point where the family, realizing that nothing was being done to aggressively investigate the disappearance of this son who they knew had not walked away from his life. They came here themselves a month later. Now, Clarence is a retired big city cop from San Jose, and he had a background in homicide and missing persons. So he launched his own very meticulous investigation, and you can see his case notes on the website, patcollinscase.com. You can see the letters that they wrote to and from the university. They could see right away that clearly there was evidence of foul play. For instance, the calendar sheet for March was missing in his apartment, even though it was March 22nd or 23rd that when he disappeared. And
I think that between the two of us, we're jumping around a bit.
Yes.
You know everything about the case. You've been following it for decades. I'm familiar with it because I've read all the articles in The Hook and other places that you've printed this. I've done my homework. Next week's issue of The Hook will have this as its cover story. You can find it online now at readthehook.com. You can go to patcollinscase.com and read sort of the WikiLeaks materials. And so you and I are jumping here and there. And the people who are not familiar with the case because they've moved into Charlottesville over the last several years, the people who haven't read the articles since the last time they were printed, I want to go, you know, A, B, C, D, not A, B, tangent,
yes,
back to E, and so
oh,
on.
Yes.
So Pat Collins comes to Charlottesville to join the university. He works and seems to be happy, etc. And then on the 20, sometime in April, early April.
March 23rd.
Well, but it's in early April when someone determines that, gosh, I haven't seen him in 2 weeks. Let's find some things. And they determine that he hasn't been seen since the 22nd. And that, but there's an ATM receipt on March 23rd.
Yes.
Okay. And the university police department is called in and goes there and commits one of the greatest mistakes that can be committed by going through his backpack, correct?
Yes.
Now go through that a little bit because this shows whether or not you want to say it's a mistake, there's certainly someone who has taken the decision that this isn't a potential murder. This is someone who's walked away. Because these are the two issues, correct? These
yes.
are the two paths that you go down when having the conversation about what happened to Pat Collins.
Right.
And as someone like yourself who's the author who's taken the one path about this is a murder mystery, why? Why do you go this way? Why do you take that path? And the police officer took the other.
Well, I think that she was probably, especially back then, I think they're better trained now, but the UVA police officers at that time were really very inexperienced. They'd certainly never investigated a possible homicide. Mike Sheffield had never had police training. He had been a kind of security officer, public relations guy, and got put out in a patrol car and worked his way up in 7 years to police chief. You also have to understand that universities had a powerful desire not to have any bad publicity, especially to do with crime. So much so that it had to be made a federal crime to cover this kind of stuff up. But back then, and even very recently at other universities, and recently at UVA with its handling of rape, as has been covered a lot in The Hook lately, the university's first reaction is to insist that nothing happened. And I think that once UVA got started down that path, the egos at the police department were so bruised by, in part by Clarence, this actual big city retired cop coming in. And every time the Shannon said something like, well, but shouldn't you do some forensic work on the apartment? They would brush him off and say, oh, no, 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 everything's fine. We're in control here. You know, go away. So, for instance, by handling all the stuff that was in Pat's backpack, you know, she tainted the evidence. But then when the Shannons finally, after a month, just gave up and just they were bitterly disappointed and went home, they handed Barbara, Pat's mother, a box as they were leaving. And she didn't think about it, just took the box. They got home. They found out that UVA had shipped all the stuff from that they had found in room 486 home with them. So in other words, there was never going to be any possibility of that evidence being admissible.
486 being the classroom or the room the at room the university in Jordan Hall where they found
he had a desk. Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. So I mean they even what potential evidence they had in Jordan Hall, they sent home to California. They were that, you know, that convinced that no crime had taken place. Or I suspect if they did start worrying about it, they didn't have the integrity to say, wait, let's put the brakes on. Let's back up here. It looks like maybe he did run into some foul play. We're sorry we rushed to judgment. But they did not have the integrity to do that, to the point that a year later, when there was an attack in Jordan Hall on a female graduate student, and a reporter asked a UVA police officer whether it could have a connection to what happened to Pat, he said, no, there's no evidence of foul play. Items were missing consistent with the person who walked away from his life, but wouldn't say what that was. Now, I have a letter that's on the WikiLeaks site saying that from the chief of police Sheffield saying that this particular officer, Morris, would be staying in touch with the Shannons if anything developed. Not only did he not do that, but he gets up a week or so later and announces that he has evidence that their son's alive. Does he call him up and say, oh, guess what? We've got this evidence. We just realized something so crucial is missing. Pat must have walked away. No. Because I, as far as I'm concerned, he lied. And Deke Bowen, the chief of police for the city, told me later in 1997 that he remembered that and that there was a feeling in the police community like, oops, Bill kind of put his foot in it there. I think everyone knew full well that Morris had lied, that there was not a question that he had lied. But they would not have the integrity to retract the statement.
Is Officer Morris still available?
No.
Is he not asking you, not answering your questions?
Both.
Or?
He died in 1996, but my editor, Haas Spencer, who originally, back in 96, wanted to work on this case, called up, and Morris, several months before his death, refused to talk about it. I called his widow, and she said, oh, I'm not going to talk about that, and that was all.
All right, we are talking about Pat Collins' mystery from 1986, 25-year anniversary, Barbara Norden, on the show today. Next week's cover story in The Hook, you're getting a little pre-information here. You can go to the patcollinscase.com, sort of a WikiLeaks site. Next week's cover story, you can pick it up in The Hook. 11:19 here on The Wake Up Call. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, highs in the mid-50s. Mostly cloudy, 20% chance of rain tonight, lows 40 to 45. And then mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, highs 65 to 70 in the mid-70s in Lynchburg. Right now in the fair all around in the valley, 43, 45 in Lynchburg, 46 in Richmond, 46 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And support today also coming from Ben Around Tattoos in Charlottesville and downtown Waynesboro, featuring male and female tattoo artists. Ben Around Tattoos has thousands of designs available and can create work from a design that you provide. You can find them in downtown Waynesboro, here in Charlottesville at 701 West Main Street. For more information online, benaroundtattoos.com. You can also find a little help at Blue Ridge Graphics. They're at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom t-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and brgtshirts.com. Now back with our guest, Barbara Norton, as we talk about Pat Collins. I'll give you the phone number for those of you who have a question now, 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Lots of questions and information to go, because Barbara, this is just, it's just such an interesting, but there's so many questions in this case about why one person did this, why another person believes that.
Yes.
And you can go online now and read this, read your article now, readthehook.com. And people have already done so and are making their comments, as right. are available everywhere at almost all articles from The Hook, and which I find interesting because people are reading this before it's even printed. Not everybody needs the paper in their hands
right.
to do this. You already made the comment. You said something about the possibility of Pat Collins being gay. What does this have to do with it? Because that's in one of the comments. It says, what difference does it make that Pat Collins may be gay? Why even say that?
You know, that really took me aback that the reader had kind of missed the point. I learned when I opened my own investigation in 1996, one of the kinds of ways UVAPD didn't investigate was they never went over to Montrose Avenue and talked to his neighbors. So I talked to the next door neighbor 10 years later, and found out that Pat had apparently been stalked by another man. The woman who is now dead, Agnes Beard, told me that between 5 and 7 times she had seen a man coming over between around like 7:30 in the evening, and the man would stand on their side of the fence, and these two houses are practically touching, but the guy would come down the fence on their side and stand there watching across to Pat's apartment. Sometimes she would see Pat come out and they would leave together. Other times she didn't, though she was so freaked out by this that she would just close the curtains and go into another part of the house. She would kind of yank the curtains closed. She wanted him to know that she was not happy he was there. People have said, well, why didn't she call the police? Well, she knew Pat. She liked Pat. She could tell this was someone he knew. She wasn't going to call the police on him. But at the same time, it bothered her, and she told me that she always wondered if that had had something to do with it. Now, whether Pat himself was gay or not, I suspect that he had attracted the attention of someone who had fixated on him. And I think that the natural place for him to have met such a person was in Mem Gym, where he was working out with the gymnastics club. Now, anyone who is familiar with the men's locker room there, or a men's locker room apparently just about anywhere, will tell you that it was a gay cruising ground. That's kind of a given, apparently, maybe more so in collegiate locker rooms.
Why do you say that? I mean, I go to ACAC, and there's a male ground, and nobody's ever cruised at me.
I actually ran ads in the, I was writing back then for Seville Weekly and in the Washington Blade, the gay publication up in D.C., looking for men who had worked out there in 86, and got very graphic responses of incidents that they had, these men had recounted for me. Also, knowing gay friends here, I worked with a postdoc in microbiology who had actually been followed after being kind of stalked through the waiting room, had been followed by a guy when he left the gym. And Mem Gym, like, for instance, Cabell Hall, the fifth floor men's room in Cabell Hall, was the spot to go for many, many years. That's why all the restrooms are locked in Cabell Hall after, I think, 7 o'clock in the evening. There's only one for each sex or something, that whole building open at night, because it was so notorious. This is part of gay culture, and unfortunately, largely a reaction to repression and discrimination. But especially in the mid-80s, it was bad. Now, 1993, a man who was later the president of the Charlottesville Albemarle, or no, actually, he was, I won't say, he very, very close to that time, he was actually the president of the Bar Association here, was arrested and pled guilty to indecent exposure for a very egregious sexual behavior toward a law student in this big, dank communal shower. So it was well known. I don't think this is still going on because they've dropped this policy where people who don't have any connection to the university could use the facilities.
But why does this matter that Pat Collins might be gay?
My focus isn't so much, though I do think he may have been edging out of the closet. My point is whether he was gay or not, he had attracted someone who was fixated on him. And I think that man killed him. I mean, I think that's kind of the only natural conclusion. How many times do you know of someone who has someone coming after dark or in the evening to stand in a neighbor's backyard and watch his apartment? If he knows him, go up and knock on the door. You know, this is such aberrant behavior. And the landlady, unfortunately, is dead, but her sister told me that once her sister, the landlady, Mrs. Laundrie, told her that one night Pat had come home and there was some kind of commotion out the curb, like someone had brought him home. And that, to me, it would be odd, too, to have some young single graduate student actually having some kind of verbal altercation loud enough for someone in a house to be looking out the window and saying, what's going on out there? This was a quiet, studious, very solitary graduate student. And the same guy has someone on the neighbor's side of the fence, you know, watching him over and over, waiting for him to come out. This, to me, suggests stalking behavior, period. I'll go to the mat with anyone on whether that's normal behavior or not. And I think that whoever was stalking him because he was attracted to him sexually. I think perhaps there had been some kind of incident and the other man wouldn't stop. There's also the weekend in the Poconos, which to me is hyper, hyper riveting, because he went up to the Poconos one weekend in February with two fellow graduate students, Doug Creedon and Jeff Weiss, and then a postdoc, John Zisk. Now, Weiss's parents owned the cabin, so he couldn't get away with lying to me and saying he hadn't been there, but the other graduate student, Doug Creedon, did. He lied to me face-to-face in 1996.
And how do you know he lied?
Because I knew, I assumed that the Daily Progress had reported in 86 that he had been there. And I took his word for it. At the time, I thought, oh, that's strange. I guess the Progress got it wrong. The following spring, and I have this on tape, we talked on the phone, and I said, had you ever been to Jeff's cabin? And he said, I had been other times, but I wasn't there that weekend with Pat. I still didn't think that he was lying. And then when I talked to John Zisk, he said, oh, for heaven's sakes, Doug was there. I remember him cross-country skiing in the moonlight. And later, 4 years later, I emailed him and I said, look, were you there or not? And he said, yeah, I was, but I can't remember anything. Same thing Jeff Weiss said. I can't remember anything. I think something either happened at the Poconos somehow, or something happened later. I don't know. I think it's disturbing that they would profess not to remember anything when the third guy remembers details about the weekend. You know, I talked to him 11 years later, and he remembered details about the weekend. And the other two are swearing they barely remember a thing.
11:29 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Barbara Norden. She's an author. And next week, this will be the topic of the Hooks issue, cover story. Pat Collins' mystery, was it a murder or did he walk away? And that depends on who you ask. Barbara takes the murder side. UVA Police Department seems to think that Pat walked away. And we're going through some of the issues that have put Barbara on this path. You can call up and ask your own question, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. You can find the article online already, readthehook.com. You can find a lot of information, sort of a WikiLeaks, at patcollinscase.com. Barbara, one of the things that caught my attention most in this entire article is that the page of the March calendar has been torn away while at least there are 7 or 8 days less left in the month.
Yes. Very troubling. I think that if Deke Bowen, if the city police had been on that case, I think that they would have gone into that apartment and said, something's not right. There was a cigarette butt in the trash. She was a non-smoker, and the calendar sheet was missing. I think that they would have had forensic people all over that apartment fingerprinting. I think they would have extensively interviewed everyone in that department and everyone in the neighborhood or surrounding that house. UVA PD didn't even go talk to his landlady. She was in the UVA hospital for 6 weeks, and they didn't even interview her. So they were not interested in really investigating. Now, the FBI came in the form of a Richmond agent named Ed Sulzbach. They called him in on an informal basis, and he was there apparently mainly to profile Pat. I have the feeling that from the first, they were determined to paint him as, they would use words like loner. Well, he wasn't a loner. He'd only moved here in December. He'd only been in an apartment for 10 weeks when he disappeared. He was studying hard. He was very focused on his studies. And I think that they were looking for someone to help them paint him as someone who got desperate and abandoned his life. Well, the following fall, after the parents had criticized the university so much, the vice president for administration of the time, Ray Hawes, wrote to Sulzbach, who had a very superficial involvement, and said, would you give us your independent evaluation of this, the handling of this case? And he wrote back and just praised it up one side and down the other. When I talked to him in 1997, and I have this on tape, he was shocked to find out that, in fact, there really hadn't been an investigation. I mean, far from, they said in the paper he had, you know, suggested avenues of pursuit. Well, he might have started with, well, why don't you talk to the neighbors? He didn't know that they hadn't. He told me he didn't know that they hadn't talked to more than a few people in the department. He didn't know they hadn't done forensic examination of the apartment. When I talked to him a couple weeks ago, he said he was sorry about the letter. He said that he had written it to, quote unquote, take the heat off UVA for the criticism they were getting so they could continue their investigation, which they didn't have anyway. He said that it was incomprehensible to him, his word, that they wouldn't have investigated the disappearance. And he said that's craziness. So that FBI letter was used, and if you look, go to the website and read the various letters, especially the later ones, you will see that at every turn, that letter was shoved in the family's face, finally by Governor Belisle's office in the form of a review by Mary Sue Terry's office, the Attorney General. Well, look, the FBI certified. The FBI said this was thorough, professional. Like, what more can we do? The FBI. Well, that guy's now, you know, very sorry he wrote it. Had no idea what he was doing at the time.
Is there anything that can be done? I mean, you know, it's however many years later, 25 years later. Is there anything you can go back to that FBI person and say, you know, slap him on the hand or anything more?
He's retired now. I'm trying to interest other media and open government people, you know, open government records types, Virginia Coalition for Open Government, in looking at this seriously. I would love to think that the FBI, knowing that Sulzbach has admitted this, would go back in and say, we had no idea. We had no idea that he had endorsed an investigation that included such things as refusing to do a forensic investigation. And now they say they sent that calendar sheet to Richmond for analysis and that it didn't show up any imprints or indentations. Like, I think you can't help but think that if a killer took the sheet, it was because he saw something on it about himself, a date, a phone number, a name. Sulzbach didn't even ask. So he was clearly here only to paint a picture of a solitary graduate student and therefore deduce, as if, oh yeah, gay men do all that all the time. I have lots of gay men friends who've disappeared from their lives because they felt a little awkward about coming out. I don't think so. Plus, he was on the other side of the country. he was kind of set free by being on the East Coast, and he was really excited about school. And you know, he was writing to a friend, his friend Maria, about how he was excited about spring coming to Charlottesville because he wouldn't have to ride through ice and stuff and on his bike. And you know, this is ludicrous.
Let me thank Sugar Snap for allowing us to have this conversation with Barbara Norton about the Pat Collins mystery. Sugar Snap, offering gently used baby and kids items, including shoes and hats, plus maternity and nursing clothes. Also at Sugar Snap, you'll find cloth diapers, nursery gear, and locally made items. They have a kid-friendly play area, and you can become a fan of Sugar Snap on Facebook or Twitter. More online, sugarsnapconsignment.com. All right, 11:36 here with Barbara Norton. Barbara, you mentioned we are talking about Pat Collins and the murder mystery. A cigarette butt left in the house when he doesn't smoke.
Yes, and I noticed that the second commenter on the Hooks website kind of said in a kind of jeering kind of way, the first one has said, oh, why is she going after the fact that he might have been gay? And then he says, and last time the cigarette butt meant a black male lover. And what I had said, and this is true, and a later comment said true, overwhelmingly cool, at least in the mid-80s, was a cigarette brand smoked mainly by black men. My thinking was that the guy at the fence perhaps was watching Pat seeming to develop a relationship with a man who perhaps, if he was a smoker, may have been black, or just a friendship even, and may have become, you know, gotten into a jealous rage.
But wouldn't the neighbor hanging, I mean, it just seems, and again, I'm going to stereotype, wouldn't the neighbor who the watcher was on her side of the fence have said there was a black guy standing there watching, not just a man?
No, that's what I'm saying. The guy at the fence, I'm sure, was white. What I have always suspected is perhaps the cigarette butt suggested that Pat had become friendly with a black person, a black man, whether as a lover or as a friend, and that the person watching this, who was fixated on him, became enraged. And I say that if he wasn't a non-smoker, the one way a non-smoker would be more likely to let someone smoke near them anyway would be, say, if he said, oh, just step out on the porch and smoke. The guy steps out, hands his cigarette, grinds it out, comes in, runs it under the water, gets water stained, which it was, and tosses it in the trash. My only point about the cool cigarette butt was I wondered if Pat had had a visitor, a lover, a friend who was black, and that the person watching him was observing this and was jealous and became enraged. That's the reason I'm bringing in the blackness, possibly.
So it may not have even been that the friend was black. It's just that the friend smoked a cool. You could have left.
Yeah, sure.
You could have left the description of black out of the friend who put out the cigarette, who brought it inside and washed it out underwater.
Yeah, you could. Now I'm not. I think I may not be completely going off on a tangent because there were a couple reports from neighbors of seeing a black man. There's. What can you say 25 years later? I don't know. But I think that these details are important, that it's not just kind of, hallucinating to say, okay, you have a rigid anti-smoker and you find a water-stained cool cigarette butt in his trash. This is a sign that someone was here.
And as possibly the person leaving the comment in the on the on-sign story, the goal is not to stereotype or not stereotype or be concerned if there's a stereotype about a cool cigarette. The goal is to get more information from people who might have something trigger their memory or their thoughts.
That's all. I am totally pro-gay. And it's shocking to me that people would see that I am wondering if Pat could have had a visitor who was black, who smoked a cigarette, and therefore make it out that I am homophobic and racist. I'm saying that this guy could have had a male friend who was African American, and that possibly the presence of a cool cigarette butt in his anti-smoker's trash might suggest that. Duh. This is kind of, I think, no-brainer to say any competent police force would have looked at that as prime evidence of something unusual. Period. That's all I'm saying.
11:40 on the wake-up call, talking with Barbara Norden about the Pat Collins mystery. Barbara has been covering this for more than a decade. You can go to her new website, patcollinscase.com. 11:41.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, winners of the 2011 Hook Fiction Contest are revealed. Judge John Grisham has selected three winners. Meet the three and read the first place story. With the recent nuclear catastrophe in Japan, local folks are asking if something similar could happen here at the North Anna Nuclear Plant. And Debbie Ryan, UVA's woman basketball coach, steps down. The Hook, convenient for your family. And Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is also helping us be on air, featuring over 130 styles of sandals, hiking and trail running shoes for women, men, and kids. And to go with your footwear, Blue Ridge also has a selection of socks and trekking poles. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is where outdoor spring adventures have begun for over 30 years. In the Barracks Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville, in Richmond, and at BRMS.com. And we also want to thank Brenda and Bill Jones, Elaine Chester, and Gene McCusker for contributing to WNRN's fund drive this past fall. It's because of people like you that the Wake Up Call is on air every Sunday. It's also because of program underwriters like the ones you're hearing from this hour, as well as Greer and Associates and Stereotypes. Stay tuned, tell a friend, and tune in next Sunday because it will be fundraiser time here on the Wake Up Call. My 7-year-old nephew will be joining me as we interview folks from Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squads. All right, back with Barbara Norden. Barbara, you have that that new website, the patcollinscase.com, sort of WikiLeaks thing. Tell me about some of the new items. You've had these several articles over the past 15 years or so. One of the things that caught my attention most was you have these letters from the president of UVA at the time, Robert O'Neill. I hadn't seen those before, and there's a couple other things. Why put this website up now?
And now I've got six binders full of this stuff. And I want people who are interested in the case, I want them to be able to judge for themselves. You can be Nancy Drew. You can go to that website. You can read the letters that were flying back and forth, the notes about conversations, the case notes that Clarence took as soon as they arrived in Charlottesville on May 8th. You can listen to Pat's answering machine tape, which to me is one of the most interesting things that I've got up there. You can hear Pat's voice, which is very gentle and sweet. And then you can experience all these hang-ups. There were few messages, but otherwise there's one hang-up after another. And I asked on the website for anyone who understood the technology of mid-80s Radio Shack answer machines to tell me what the different sounds meant. Well, if you look at those posts, they're from two guys who I appreciate so much for adding the information they did. The person was largely only listening to the message and then hanging up, not waiting for the beep at which if you hang up after the beep, the hang up is perceived as a message and there's no long busy signal. If you hang up as soon as the message ends before the beep, then you go into like 30 seconds. They seem unending, these beeps intervals. But the second man said, the hang-ups, the number of people, persons just calling to either listen to his voice or listen and then hang up after the beep, seemed morbid to him, as if the person were just wanted to hear his voice. And I have always felt that about the answering machine tape, that it was abnormal that he would have so many calls where the guy, the caller just hung up. Didn't leave a message, hung up over and over and over. And as the guy pointed out, that's not unheard of after a murder, to want to obsess over hearing the person's voice, that kind of thing.
What about one of the things, again, I mentioned that UVA President Robert O'Neill had a back and forth series of letters yes. with Pat Collins' family. But it was like 10 weeks later.
Oh, it's shocking. Can you imagine if Castine had waited 10 weeks after Morgan Harrington disappeared to even mention in a brief letter to the Harringtons, oh, by the way, too bad about your daughter. But that's really what Robert O'Neill did. He waited until 10 weeks had gone by. The Shannons had already been here for a month and gone, and he writes his letter saying, oh, by the way, I meant to get with you while you were here, but, oh, geez, it's too bad about your son. Sorry, see you around. We'll keep you in touch if, like, we learn anything. And, you know, Robert O'Neill was not a very strong presence at the university. I can just see Mike Sheffield, the UVA police chief at the time, saying, Mr. O'Neill, we know this young man was gay and he didn't want to come out to his family, but we don't want to upset the family either. And, you know he walked away. Now, here's an interesting little tidbit. I'll put this on the site soon. I had a former boss at the medical center who had chaired a task force back in the mid-80s, and Sheffield had been on the task force. It was for drug and alcohol abuse. And when I opened my investigation in the, you know, late 90s, I had lunch with my former boss, and he said, you know, I remember when that happened. And one day at a task force meeting, I said to Mike, just kind of to sort of express sympathy for what a complicated, you know, I said something like, oh, this sounds like a really complicated case. And he said that Sheffield had told him, oh, the public, there are things the public can't know. That boy was sighted in San Francisco 3 weeks after he disappeared. So I wrote Sheffield next time I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and I'm going to mention those requests in a minute. And I said, oh, and by the way, Dr. So-and-so says that you told him back in 1986 that Pat had been sighted in San Francisco. So what's that about? And he wrote back, denying my Freedom of Information Act or FOIA request, and said, I never said that to Dr. So-and-so or anyone else. I'm going to send Lieutenant Mike Abbott around to interview you and to determine the validity of the source. And I wrote back and said, well, look, I respectfully decline, but on the other hand, Mike, you are supposedly the original source. So why would you send him to interview me? He needs to interview you. I mean, this is the mentality of what was going on. It, you know, we said a minute ago that the university has always said he walked away. Yes, they have. Then why do they refuse Freedom of Information Act requests? They've refused seven since 1991, saying that they can't, they will not disclose the case file because it's a criminal investigation.
So they're playing both sides.
Oh, yes. I mean, first they announced to the press in March of 87, 1 year later, that they have evidence that Pat Collins walked away from his life and is basically alive. But then 4 years later, the grieving family says, well, hey, let us see the police file. And they say, oh, no. It's a criminal investigation. We can't let you see it. Now, if you believe that Pat Collins walked away, picture this being your child. This university says to the press, they have evidence that your child is alive and walked away. So instead of calling you and saying, guess what? We figured it out. He must have had a breakdown. He walked away from his life. He's alive. And giving you the evidence so that you might, you know, hire an investigator or run advertisements in papers or something to find him. You just clamp down and say, oh, no, now we've decided it's criminal because then we don't have to show you any of our records.
11:50 on the wake-up call, talking with Barbara Norden about the Pat Collins mystery, and we're allowed to do this because of support from the backyard, University's Culinary Secret at the end of Elliewood Avenue. Now through the 19th, I guess that ended yesterday, St. Patrick's Week. Sorry if you missed it, but the backyard has a seasonal menu and is available for private events. For more info, including all the parties at the backyard, call them up 202-8215 or thebackyarduva.com. Barbara, it's 11:50. We've been talking about the Pat Collins mystery, and there's still some things to go over. But you've now put together a website. The Hook is printing an article. It seems fine, 25 years later. But why? Again, I understand the need to have the mystery solved. You spent so much time and effort on this. But why? Has the university changed any of their rules about the police department?
Well, the university never would have voluntarily changed anything. No university would. Interestingly enough, the day after Pat's disappearance was discovered, Gene Cleary, who was a freshman at Lehigh, was discovered after having been raped, tortured, mutilated, strangled, and generally murdered in her dorm room. The parents learned that Lehigh was aware of security lapses in dorms, of doors being propped open with pizza boxes and stuff, and had not acted on it. So the Clearys sued, and with the settlement and their own money, they established Security on Campus, which is an advocacy group that has pressed for state and national laws. So now, as of 1996, with the Cleary Act, it is a federal crime. Federal crime, 1990, for a university to cover up crime statistics. That's why every UVA employee gets a yellow postcard every year saying where they can go on the website to see the crime statistics. And they are guilty of failure to warn if there's any chance of danger to students that they don't warn. Virginia Tech was found guilty of that, for instance. So universities now are strongly advised that they better not do that. The reason I think that the university has got to do something is they are on record saying that this studious, energetic, wonderful, devoted young man who was very close to his family wanted to actually abandon his life and leave them. And that is a horrible thing to do to a family's memory, to his memory. The family will never recover from this. UVA lied. They let a murderer go free. And why shouldn't they be held accountable? Why shouldn't? I'll be pressing this. I'll be here for the 30th anniversary. I'll be here for the 35th. You may not want to have me on anymore, but I'm going to keep saying this was a terrible, terrible shame on UVA's history, just a stain on it, and they need to apologize to the family. I think that President Sullivan or the Attorney General needs to say that if someone comes forward with information, they sure are not going to give it to the UVA police. They should be giving it to the state police or city police, Albemarle County, someone else, but not UVA.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that I wouldn't want to have you on. I think that's an incredibly interesting story. But I think that that's a question that a lot of people are sitting out there thinking, well, why are you still caught up in this? And why put it on the website? And to me, what it says is you're trying to find the killer by spreading the news as best you can, and the website being, I guess, the more modern way to do that.
Yes.
And part two of it is to embarrass the university and the university police department so that similar things don't happen in the future.
Absolutely. You know, anyone who can take in the details of this case and defend the university, here's the deal I'll make with you. That's okay. As long as you tell me that if your child disappeared and you knew the child had been murdered because you knew your child, you would be okay with an institution saying, oh, no, we're just sure she or he wanted to just get out of her life. You would be okay with sitting back and saying, this is acceptable. And if that really is acceptable to you, there's nothing more I can say to try to convince you that the university should have investigated a student's disappearance. But you have to say it would be all right with me and my family if we were treated this way. It wouldn't be okay with me.
You know, one of the things, where do you believe that the murderer is, since you believe it's a murderer, and where do you believe that the body might be?
I believe it was someone who knew Pat's routine very well, who knew him well enough to know where his desk was in room 486 at Jordan Hall, and who could murder him and take his stuff back up there afterwards and make it look like he had been there. I think it was someone who knew him well enough to know where he lived and who had gone back into the apartment after the murder and taken the calendar sheet and run through to see if there was any other incriminating evidence. I think it was someone who had access, whether here or outside Charlottesville, to a site where he could bury Pat. I do not believe he's buried under the new hospital, because I think that those excavation pits were too closely monitored before each concrete pour for a body to just be covered up by a little dirt down there. I think that the person probably was charismatic and athletic and charming and probably went on with his life. I suspect if he was working out at Mem Gym, I imagine he was a graduate student and that he went on to some kind of life. He may have killed again for all we know.
This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Just our last couple minutes with Barbara Norden as we talk about the Pat Collins case, online at readthehook.com. This will be the upcoming week's cover story for The Hook. You can also go to patcollinscase.com to get pictures and information that has been copied on that isn't in this week's Hook, correct?
It's what?
It isn't. Those things, the Pat Collins case items,
right,
are sort of
extras.
That's
my doing. That is entirely my doing. I love unsolved crime, obviously, and I would have eaten up this kind of website for a true crime story where I could, be walking through Charlottesville with Barbara and Clarence and documenting every day what they did while they were here and listening to the answering machine tape, reading Pat's letters to his friend Maria. I would have been just hanging on every word. So, I think it's time for people to see how UVA responded to this family. Now, interestingly enough, Ed Salzbach, the FBI agent, told me that he assumed from the beginning that Pat had been murdered. He was surprised that his body hadn't been found up on the Blue Ridge the following fall by hunters. So he never questioned that Pat was dead.
Real quick, we don't have time for this last question. What is the family doing now?
Well, the brother, Michael, carries on the effort, hoping that someday, and the mother too, Barbara, that someone will be held responsible and that UVA will be revealed for its behavior toward them and toward Pat. Clarence was so deeply embittered by this. He's in very bad health. They right now don't want him to even know that I've reopened it because they're afraid that it would just push him over the edge and that he'd have one last heart attack. So he apparently does not know. If any listeners are interested, if you can forward the case files and the article to people in California or mid-80s Charlottesville, anything like that, if we can get the word out, maybe we can solve it.
All right. Again, pick up this coming week's Hook, like you do every week, to get the article, patcollinscase.com. And then tune in again next week. It's because of fundraisers and the folks who make your donation, it's that kind of thing that we can have Barbara Norden on. Next week we'll have Dayton Haw from the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad. And get your checkbooks nice and limber. Barbara, thank you so much.
Thank you. I love coming on here. Well,
thank you. I love having you. It's always you always have such interesting stories. All right. Adios.
Audio.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday, and by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasolines, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.